Okay, let's go on to one of our current speakers, current group members, and I say current, but technically we just ended about a month ago. Eric Shoebridge joined the group in 2001. He's a James McGill Professor in the Department of Human Genetics and in the Department of Neurology and Neurosurgery, and he's going to tell us about his work on mitochondrial disorders.
Disappeared. So my Rima said that genetics started in just cancel that in 1950, and that's when my own personal genetics started, and an apparently normal, healthy baby boy was born at the Toronto General Hospital in 1951 as a result of that experiment.
I
had to say something while the slides were coming up. So in 15 minutes, I'm not sure how I'm going to summarize this, but I'll take a shot at it. As Rima said, I joined the group a little bit late. We were interested in the last two rounds, and we'd been interested for some time in my lab in a group of disorders that affect the mitochondrial respiratory chain, which is the business end of energy production in almost all of our cells. And it's genetically a little bit complicated because two genomes contribute to it. The mitochondrial genome, which only encodes for a handful of proteins, only 13, but they're absolutely essential, and everything else from the nuclear genome. In fact, there's a huge genetic investment in the cell to produce these 13 proteins. There's a few hundred proteins at least that are necessary to produce that. And so you wonder why evolution kept that. And I can tell you what my thoughts are at another time. So these diseases were actually thought to be pretty rare about 20 years ago, but there are a couple of epidemiological studies now suggesting that the birth incidence is about 1 in 5,000, which is reasonably common for a genetic disease. And as you can imagine from the two genomes here, they come in two flavors, nuclear genes, which can be dominant or recessive, or mitochondrial DNA mutations. These tend to be less severe with later onset, but about 20% of the very severe cases are, in fact, due to mitochondrial DNA mutations. And when we tried to join the group the first time, we were particularly interested in the recessive diseases because nobody had really tackled those. And at that time, around 1995 or so, not a single one had been identified in the mitochondrial respiratory chain. And part of the reason is because the pedigrees usually look like this, at least in North America. There were two apparently normal, healthy parents who had a child who died, who had the disease onset very early in life and died in the first days, weeks, months, or years of life. Almost all the diseases were fatal, but birth was normal by and large. They presented with severe lactic acidosis because they couldn't make energy in their mitochondria. And they had either a brain, heart, or a liver disease, or a combination of those things. And the question was, what could you do about it? So we had an idea, and we had a bunch of patients at the time who had defects in one of the enzymes in this respiratory chain called cytochrome oxidase, happens to be the last enzyme in the chain. And the structure of it was known. There are three subunits encoded in the mitochondrial genome and 10 nuclear encoded. And the reason we wanted to work on this was because a few labs around the world at that time had sequenced all the structural subunits in a variety of patients, and a large number of patients who had biochemical deficiencies in this enzyme and could not identify a genetic defect. And so we thought, and it was a relatively common presentation in the pediatric population, and we thought if we could identify the genetic defects there, we'd find out some new biology. So we wouldn't just find a gene, a mutation in a structural gene. And so that was the idea. And we had an idea on how to do it. Since they're almost all recessive disorders here, we thought, well, if we could stick in a normal copy of the normal gene, we should be able to rescue it. So we could clone it by functional complementation, because we obviously couldn't do linkage in pedigrees that look like that. And the way we would do this was something called microcell-mediated chromosome transfer that had been used up to that time largely to look for tumor suppressor genes. And the idea is rather simple. You put in a normal chromosome that you can follow into a cell line from a patient that has a phenotype. If it's a recessive disorder, if you put in a normal copy of the gene, you rescue it, you can figure out what the gene is eventually. Well, the MRC at the time didn't like that idea because they said it wouldn't work. At least one of the reviewers said it wouldn't work. But the March of Dimes bought into it at that time and took a risk that it would work. And we decided to work, to try it out, and on a disease called Leigh syndrome, which is one of the most common presentations in the pediatric population, described by Dennis Leigh in the same year that I was born in Toronto. And it's a subacute neurodegenerative disease that's, as I say, a very common presentation of these disorders in the pediatric population, and it's fatal. It has a very early onset in the early years of life, and most children die before they're five. And so we put in all these chromosomes one at a time, and we showed that you could actually make this work. We found this syndrome was mapped to chromosome 9, and I won't go into the gory details, but you can actually get pretty fine resolution doing this experiment, just as good as you can with genetic linkage. And we discovered that the gene that was responsible here was a gene called SERF1. It's a gene in a cluster of a locus of housekeeping genes, the function of which were not known, and it was called SERF because there was a surfeit of genes in this very small area of the chromosome. And that was all that was known. So it turned out that every patient that we looked at, and we actually asked a friend of ours, Gary Brown in Oxford, who had inherited Dennis's Leigh's cell line collection when Dennis retired from London, he was a neurologist there, for a few dyed-in-the-wool, absolutely clear-cut cases of this syndrome so that we could sort it out. And he gave us three patient lines. So we found the mutations. They were all nonsense mutations, either due to splice sites or nonsense mutations themselves. And none of the patients had any of this protein. They were all null for the protein. And so that's the case for every patient we know about in the world to date. And if you do something, a biochemical analysis of these patients, you can see that the problem with this is the failure to assemble the enzyme. This is a native gel looking at the enzyme. Here's a normal control. And in the patients who have these mutations, they only make this much of the enzyme, and they accumulate an intermediate. And if you see that in a patient with Leigh syndrome, can't assemble the enzyme, 100% of them have mutations in this gene. So we solved the problem. And then we went back to the MRC and tried to get into the group again. And this time we succeeded, although one of the reviewers said, well, the gene was obvious. It had a flashing red light on it. Nonetheless, they gave us the grant and said we could continue to do this. So we've continued to do it, and we found a number of other genes. We found all of these things except for this one, which was found in a group by a group in France. And what you can see is that the patients who have these mutations in these genes, all of which are assembly factors or accessory factors for putting together this enzyme, have a wide variety of phenotypes. And that is one of the great mysteries in the field. One of the great challenges is how come these housekeeping genes, which are all responsible for putting together this enzyme complex, actually have such a huge variety of clinical phenotypes? And we don't know the answer to that. And I just wanted to highlight, since I was asked maybe to highlight some of the most recent stuff in the lab, one of the most recent discoveries was this gene called TACO1, which produces a very late onset Leigh syndrome. And all the affected members of the family that we studied are actually still alive. And some of them are in their 20s. And they get Leigh syndrome, the classical Leigh syndrome, plus optic atrophy. And it turns out to be due to a protein that's involved in the translation of one single polypeptide that's encoded in mitochondrial DNA. So this gel here is labeling, is a translation experiment that labels all the different components of mitochondrial DNA, all the genes that are encoded there. And you can see here, this cytochrome oxidase 1, which is part of this enzyme, isn't made properly in these patients. It's kind of a smudge. So the protein that we now track down by this chromosome transfer technique is actually responsible for translating that single protein properly. Okay, so there's a known protein that's responsible, at least one, for making sure that that gets translated properly. And if I go back one slide here, I won't talk about this one, but this one is also responsible for translating that one properly. And it turns out that that thing has been highly conserved throughout evolution, although its function was totally unknown. So in gray here is shown the structure of a closely related protein that has this DUF28. Who knows what DUF28 is? Nobody. You know why? It's called domain of unknown function, number 28. We haven't got a clue what it is, but somebody sequenced a hypothetical protein from a hypothermophilic bacterium that lives at 96 degrees, and it's 50% similar to this human protein that's responsible for translating this one gene encoded in mitochondrial DNA that causes Leigh syndrome when mutated. So we have no idea what it does. It might be responsible for starting translation, for finishing translation. All we know is it can't make that one protein properly. And we looked, these days it's getting easier to look at these genes and what they do, but not real simple. And we looked in some of these databases and found out that it interacted with something called ICT1. ICT1 stands for immature colon cancer, immature colon carcinoma tumor 1. And it was found in some random screen by somebody in a cell line. What's ICT1, we thought? Maybe it's got to do, it's interacting with this thing. Well, it turns out that ICT1 is a member of a family of mitochondrial class 1 release factors. What do mitochondrial class 1 release factors do? Well, they recognize the termination codon in the mitochondrial translation apparatus. There are four of them in human mitochondria, vertebrate mitochondria. And in my, to my knowledge, there is no other organism or organelle in the world that uses four termination codons. And it turns out that in the human, in vertebrates actually, there are four putative translation termination factors that recognize the termination codon and release the fully formed polypeptide. And all they share in common are these three amino acids here, this little motif, which acts at the catalytic center of this. Why am I telling you this? Well, it turns out that ICT1 probably doesn't interact with that TACO thing, although we can't find biochemical evidence that it does. But it's related to this other open meeting frame here, which if you use, again, the 3D kinds of structural mapping things that are available to us these days, looks just like one of the release factors from bacteria. And it also turned out that we were studying a family with some collaborators in Copenhagen, and we found mutations in this gene. In a family that had Leigh syndrome, early onset Leigh syndrome, optic atrophy, and complete paralysis of their extraocular muscles. So we don't really know what these things do. We don't know why we have four different apparent termination factors. Only one of them really recognizes, only one of them has been demonstrated so far to recognize these termination codons. But it just shows you that we stumbled on these things, in fact, serendipitously, just by looking in bioinformatic databases because of all the data that's out there now, because of the human genome sequence. And I'm going to skip over this bit in the interest of time, because I want to talk about just one other thing that we've done. A lot of what we, some of the genes that we've been able to identify rather quickly because they're yeast orthologs. And the yeast that most people use in the lab to study mitochondria is Saccharomyces cerevisiae. It does not have one of the complexes that human vertebrate mitochondria have, complex 1, which is made up of 47 subunits. In bacteria, there are only 14 shown in red. That's a perfectly good complex 1 in bacteria, but humans apparently need a lot more. So I call this mergers and acquisitions. This is like the dust magnet of enzymes. It's accumulated all of this stuff over evolution, and nobody knows why it has. And there are a lot of assembly factors, presumably, that are responsible for putting it together. So we thought we would take advantage of another tool that's around now because of all the genome sequencing that's been done, would be to look at yeast families that have complex 1 and yeast families that don't. Take the whole genome, subtract them, and we should find some things that are related to complex 1. And I only have a couple more slides. That actually works. So we made a list, and we've checked it twice. Just twice so far. And these are bona fide complex 1 assembly proteins. And I'm just going to show you one more data slide. In fact, if you knock one of those things down, what you lose are two proteins. This is, again, this translation gel that are necessary to make complex 1. They just don't get translated. So there's apparently other members of this family of proteins. There's probably one for every single polypeptide in the mitochondrial genome. And that's one of the challenges, is to find all of those things. So the really big question, I think the really big challenge that nobody in this business has a really good idea about, and this I think is true for, it's true certainly for most neurodegenerative diseases, is how do mutations in ubiquitously expressed housekeeping genes actually result in tissue-specific disease? And that's an ongoing project. And I just want to acknowledge, finally, I've had a very large number of really talented students and postdocs, of course, who've done all this work, and we've got some great collaborators all around the world. Thank you very much.